My name is Marty Kobanis. I am with the Indigenous Environmental Network. We're based out of Bemidji, Minnesota. My title there is I'm the pipeline organizer.
And how do you say your last name again, or say it slowly?
Kobanis. C-O-B-E-N-A-I-S. Not the proper French terminology.
Right. And so are you organizing with indigenous groups up in Alberta to fight the tar sands development?
IEN has two full-time staff that are working on the tar sands at this time. We're looking at expanding that to four at the beginning of the year. But one of them specifically works up in Alberta, and then I work in the U.S. on different issues that are tar sands related.
Okay. Maybe you could give me a quick overview of the extent of the ecological impact of the tar sands development. How far along is it and so forth? I've heard they've already cut enough trees to, it would be the size of Florida.
Well, the total size of what the tar sands is going to be very large. When we look at where it's at in Alberta, it's not necessarily just in one spot. There's different segments and spots along in Canada where it's at in Alberta. So it's not just all in one big clump. Most of it is. What the government of Alberta says, though, is that it's going to be 140 square kilometers, or to make that U.S., since we don't switch over to metric system, is 55,000 square miles. Some people say that's larger than twice or the size of England. But then when you look into the state sizes in the United States, New York State is the 27th largest state in the U.S., and that is equivalent to the same square miles.
Okay. And this land is basically stripped of all the trees, and then what happens to it? They dig down and strip mine this entire square mileage?
Well, not the entire square mileage. What right now is they are using the mining technique where they go in, they take out the boreal forests, pristine wilderness, swamps and everything else like that that man will never remake. They remove what they call that overburden, and they go down about 180 to 100 feet deep, removing all the topsoil, and then they truck and try and save the topsoil too. But then after that, they go down and they dig to 200-300 feet deep, mining the tar sands out of the ground. And the tar sands is not like, when you think of the Beverly Hillbillies and Jeb Clampett shooting at the ground and up comes the ground, or up from the ground comes bubbling crude. This isn't that at all. This is a very thick, in the sand type of oil. It's at room temperature, it has the consistency of molasses. A cooler molasses, not like the stuff that you can pour out. So it's a really thick, you can just hold it right in your hands, though.
And how far along are they with this project? You said the size of New York State.
They're really not that far along. Over 80% of the tar sands is inaccessible and too deep for them to even use the strip mining. So what they're going to do then is another process called in situ. And what that is basically, with the mining extraction now, they have lots of waste chemicals and water to use that they use to extract the oil out of the sand and everything to make it a synthetic crude oil to go through the pipelines. So there's tons, and the tailing ponds are equivalent to 77 square miles. That's quite the area, but it's also 300 feet deep, which they leak. One tailing ponds alone that's built right on the Athabasca River, that one leaks, and this is from industry and from the government's numbers, is that it leaks 67 liters per second, or 17 gallons per second. Which just is an outrageous amount of leaking that they have going on. But going back to what in situ is that they're trying to get rid of the tailing ponds. this in situ is going to essentially do that for them, because they're going to drill down, put steam down into the ground with chemicals. So they're actually going to be doing a lot of the
hydrofracking type stuff
down there. So all these chemicals that are going, that are being used now and putting in tailing ponds, are going directly into the ground 200-300 feet deep, and they're just going to leave them there. So there won't be any more tailings ponds. There'll just be underground tanks, more or less, of chemical pollutants.
So how long has this been going on? Because there's mention that the cancer rates have gone up and there's higher mercury levels in the wildlife and in people.
The, you know, in Fort Chippewa, there's been 3 confirmed deaths and cancer of people with rare bile duct cancers. They suspect there is 2 more, but they weren't diagnosed beforehand. The bile duct cancers, excuse me, in the United States is normally 1 out of 100,000 people obtain this. Up there, it's 3 to 5 people have attained it out of 1,200 people. So, I mean, it's just an outrageous, that's like 1 out of 200 and some people that instead of the, with that then, the people up there are saying, the people from Fort Chippewa and those communities up there are saying, and the Miccosukee tribe are saying that they don't even have muskrats anymore. That was one of their main staples in their food, and that they went to trap them. And due to the chemicals being in the water and the water being polluted, that there's no more muskrats around. The last ones they've seen were 2 to 3 years ago, and those had bloody noses. And then when they'd break open their houses, they'd get a strong smell of petroleum products.
And is Fort Chippewa near the Athabasca Delta?
It is right at the mouth of where the river comes into Lake Athabasca. They're about 200 kilometers downstream north. We have to remember the continental divide here. They're downstream from the industry. And so that's just this year, two conflicting reports have come out about the water up there, one from Dr. Kevin Timoney, and the other one by the industry. Dr. Timoney said that there was definitely more chemicals and pollution in the river downstream from industry, while industry is saying it's just a natural phenomenon because there's oil sands all over and it's already naturally polluting the water.
And what's your take on that?
Well, just in thinking and in theory and on what I know as far as what the government is saying is as far as even the tailing ponds leaking, they have to, I think that, you know, it has to be polluting the river. Like I said, the one tailing pond that they say leaks 67 liters per second or 17.69 gallons per second. If you equal that out, that is 557 million gallons per year that is leaking into that river.
Okay, tell me a little bit about the Athabasca and the Delta as far as a wildlife center where a lot of migration goes on. And
well, there you have a lot of the sandhill cranes and stuff like that that go up there to nest, which is, you know, as an endangered species. They nest on the eastern edge of, or in the southeastern side of Lake Athabasca. You also have elk, caribou, moose. What's the other big ones they're having up there? They have a wild buffalo herd that's up in that area. They're finding that in even those animals, there's high mercury levels. That when they're testing them and stuff like that, there's high mercury level arsenic in conjunction, you know, that goes along with what's normally in oil production.
Okay, let's move on a little bit to the organizing. Obviously, the Indigenous Environmental Network is organizing to try and stop this, and you have such a tremendous human force being the Exxon Corporation. want to say a monolith, just a huge, you know, a huge project going on. Is what sort of chances are there of stopping it, and what's being done?
Okay, there's about 14 questions in there, and about 14 ways I can answer that. IEN has been working with grassroots organizations. That's who we work with normally. With that, though, we've been in joining in with national groups, national environmental groups, you know, in the Sierra Clubs, NWF, Friends of the Earth, NRDC, to name a few. But we also work with other groups up in Canada, like Greenpeace, Canada, RAN, Ruckus. You know, so we work with Pembina Institute is another big organization up in Canada that we work with. So we've all kind of combined our forces here to fight this. IEN is really the only Indigenous group that's involved in it. So we have a really strong connection with the Indigenous people on north of the border and south of the border, and that's where we really try to work our strategy sessions with. In Canada, we're working with people obviously in Alberta. We're also working with tribes in British Columbia that have the Northern Gateway pipeline going through. That's Enbridge pipeline. Their proposals go from Edmonton over to Prince George and run pipeline through there, and then they would ship it out on tankers through really deep valleys and everything else like that. Fjords, I guess, if you're Norwegian. But that's really what they're looking at doing. So we're fighting with them. Up there, British Columbia has all the tribes up there have signed resolutions in opposing the Keystone or the Northern Gateway pipeline. In Canada or in Alberta, several of the tribes have resisted and continue to resist the expansion of the tar sands because it's going to just cause more pollution and cause more death to their small communities. And that's really why we're fighting it, is to stop the tar sands and to save the people in that area of all the pollution that is being caused by them. But down in America, we're fighting it, doing it with, it doesn't actually, the Keystone XL doesn't go through any of the tribes per se. It goes through their traditional homelands. We're working with tribes along the route that have traditional homelands along the route and have sacred sites and burial sites and everything else like that that could and would be affected. We work with other non-Indigenous groups in Nebraska that are fighting the Ogallala Aquifer. We stand and work with local farmers, ranchers, and stuff like that and in all the states along the route and saying no to all this. But we want to try and really get a unity of the tribes to say no to it and present it to the federal government and say, you know, this is all the tribes along the route. These are the people saying no to this also. This isn't just farmers and ranchers saying this anymore, or landowners. This is other people that are along the route. You know, and then we have the heavy haul. We're campaigning, working with the Nez Perce tribe, and hoping to work with some other tribes along the route here to really get a force out and say no to this. You know, Nez Perce has already passed the resolution. The regional tribal consortium has passed a resolution opposing the heavy haul and the tar sands. And this week they were down in Albuquerque at National Congress of American Indians trying to pass a national resolution, which would be huge if we could get that.
Now, all these resolutions, are they having an impact slowing things down, or is there more going on the legal front and civil disobedience front?
I think it's going to be more on the legal fronts, and then also just to try and make it so that, you know, the Keystone XL pipeline needs to have a presidential permit, and if we can show that all the tribes along the route are opposed to it, Secretary Clinton is currently, as she says, she's inclined to already sign off on it. IEN has already signed on to letters with a couple other organizations asking her to excuse herself from the decision-making and that she should not be a part of that decision-making anymore since she's already come out and stated her position. and having a prejudice of which direction she's already going to sign, or she's leaning towards signing the presidential permit.
If the pipeline is stopped, does that stop all of ExxonMobil's plans for, or Imperial Oil's plans for tar sands extraction, or do they just use a different route?
Well, no, it doesn't. Right now, since 9/11, President Bush authorized really three pipelines to come to the United States. The Keystone one that goes through North Dakota, South Dakota, down to Cushing, Oklahoma. That one is almost completely done and up and operating. It is filled up to Sterling, Nebraska, and then it shoots over to Chicago area with a pipeline. But they're just finishing up from Sterling down to Cushing, Oklahoma now. They also built the Alberta Clipper that goes from basically North Dakota border over across Minnesota to Superior, Wisconsin. And that one is still sitting vacant. That one's completed, but they're not. They don't have the capacity to fill it yet. And now they're expecting to have this Keystone XL pipeline passed. And I can do this if you need.
Sorry.
Okay. And they are. They don't even have the capacity to fill this one yet. They don't even have the contracts to fill this. I think it's at like 50 or 60% capacity that they have the contracts for, but they don't have the capacity to fill it in production levels in Canada yet. So by stopping the heavy haul and making it so that they can increase the production, we can also help stop the Keystone XL and saying, you don't need it. You're not going to fill it. You know, the pipelines that are being built and even the production equipment that is being passed through here isn't really going to be fully in effect until 2020. That's still 10 years away, and that's how long it's going to take for them to get to proper production levels to fill all these pipelines.
Well, it seems like the tar sands project in Alberta, it's something of a juggernaut, and do you expect a crackdown on various people who protest or resist this, maybe in the name of national security because we need the oil so badly? Or is this a situation where if we could cut down our oil consumption, then it wouldn't be needed at all?
I think we could cut down our oil consumption really easily. I mean, when you look at like in history, in the 1970s, we had an oil shortage, and really the U.S. had hit its peak oil production, so that's when we started really going to the world market for oil. But then everyone started looking green energy then in thinking, that's when they put solar panels on the White House then too, and they took them off the next president that came in. Jimmy Carter put solar panels on, Reagan took them off. But I think the green energy started then, and oil became an issue. When we had 9/11 happen, gas prices going up to $120 or $140 a barrel just last couple of years ago, you know, that's really what I believe started the recession was the gas prices. And with that then, you know, the Alberta clip, or with the Alberta tar sands, 80% of the oil is so far out and is going to have to use the in situ method. It's going to cost a lot more money to get that oil. It's not even productive for them to get it until it's $120 a barrel. At that point in time, I think the U.S. and the world markets on oil are going to cry and say, you know what, we can't handle these prices anymore. And I think people are going to start going back to looking more at hydro cars, or hybrid cars, sorry, and looking at more gas-efficient vehicles, because no one's going to be able to pay $100 to gas up their big trucks anymore.
So conservation may be the way to stop this, but meanwhile there's the non-in-situ extraction that's still going on and not finished, and that's a lot cheaper because that's just a strip mining operation, and you feel that has to be stopped too.
That has to be stopped too, but even those prices are starting to increase as far as production numbers, because they've taken all the easy spots out so far, and now they have to ship it even further every day, you know, which adds up in more fuel costs and everything else, and they're not getting the production that they need. So, you know, it's going to, even the mining process is going to cost more here pretty quick.
Okay. Anything else you want to add? I think I've covered a lot of issues with you.
The one area that even the IEN is even taking on is we're taking on financial campaigns, corporate campaigns. We've gone to British, my coworker in Canada, Clayton Thomas Mueller, has gone to stockholders meetings for Exxon and or Shell and BP in England. And they were allowed to speak, and there they had 10 to 15% of the voting public, of the stockholders, saying no to supporting the tar sands even in those networks, which is huge when you think about, you know, 10, 15% of the stockholders you don't think is a very big vote, but that's actually like 5 to 10 million votes, depending on which company you're working with.
You get one vote per stock?
I think you only get one vote if you own so much stock. So it's not one vote per stock per se. So, I mean, it's just an amazing amount of votes that are saying no to this. We're also taking on banks, Royal Bank of Scotland. We've done campaigns there. We've done campaigns against the Royal Canadian Bank, which were, you know, highly successful in showing that these banks are the ones that are financing the tar sands.
That was Marty Kobanes of the Indigenous Environmental Network, interviewed November 21st at the Tar Sands Resistance Summit in Potomac, Montana. This is Jasmine Thomas of Sykes, British Columbia, who is organizing against the Northern Enbridge Pipeline Project. Interviewed November 21st at the Tar Sands Resistance Summit in Potomac, Montana. Jasmine Thomas.
Okay. I do lots of work with the Indigenous Environmental Network, and right now I'm currently employed with the Wet'suwet'en First Nation as the Environmental Justice Coordinator. And I am a member of the Frog Clan, and I come from Sykes, which is part of the Carrier Nation in central British Columbia.
Okay. First of all, tell me about the moratorium on pipelines in Western British Columbia. I don't know if I understand that completely. That's already been going on, right?
Well, we have been pushing for something like that.
It hasn't happened.
No. So there is a moratorium currently for tanker traffic on the coast, and there has been, you know, small different various tankers on the coast, but what Enbridge is planning to propose with their Northern Gateway Pipeline project is to open up our BC coast to very large crude tankers, which can carry up to 2 million barrels of oil each tanker. And it's planning to cross, you know, through the most treacherous waters in the world.
And this oil would come from the Alberta tar sands?
Yes, it would. Well, I have family in Ground Zero areas in northern Alberta, and where my father used to hunt, fish, and gather, there are now open pit mines that could be seen from space, and just the high rates of cancers and diseases that have been unheard of amongst his people and my mother's people in British Columbia has been really overwhelming. So the Northern Gateway Pipeline is planning to it's going to be a 1,170 kilometer long dual pipeline from Alberta, northern Alberta, to the coast of British Columbia. So the dual pipeline, one is going to be bringing in condensate needed to dilute the tar sands in Alberta, and then the second pipeline, once it's thinned with that toxic condensate, will be going through that second pipeline to the port of Kitimat. But the Haisla First Nation have denounced, they've all agreed that they will not allow that port coming to Kitimat. So it's posing, you know, much difficulties for Enbridge's project.
And what are some of the objections?
Well, we highly believe that, you know, if this pipeline comes through our territory, it's going to cross over 1,000 streams, 3 major river watersheds, the Fraser, Upper Fraser, the Stikeen, and a few other places. But many of the 1,000 streams that it's going to cross are salmon-bearing streams, and our people heavily depend on that food for sustenance purposes. And, you know, we identify ourselves as salmon people. So there's been many concerns around that, and, you know, just how the project is being proposed and reviewed, it's in isolation. So it's just the pipeline project by itself, and then cumulative impacts aren't really being considered, which we've been trying to push for our own independent-led review process. But Canada and BC decided to streamline their regulatory process by teaming up, and they will not listen to our concerns for our own independent-led processes.
Okay, and so what are some of the cumulative impacts? Is there concern that it will increase tanker traffic on the coast and lead to risks of spills, or what's going on here?
Well, we've already seen Enbridge's pipelines in the United States go, they've been spilling and leaking quite regularly in the past year. We've seen the spill in the Kalamazoo River in Michigan, and we have seen, you know, Enbridge break over 500 different environmental laws in Wisconsin. So we are looking at how they're acting in the United States, and how that could impact, because we know that spills will occur. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And other cumulative impacts that, you know, we are really concerned about is what, with this pipeline, the Enbridge Gateway Pipeline, it will increase production in tar sands by 30%. So we are also concerned because we are hearing the cancer rates in Fort Chipewyan, for example, they've seen an increase of cancers by 30%. So we are concerned in BC, if we allow such a project to go through our territories, would it increase cancer rates in those communities in Alberta to high as 60%, or even wipe them out? So those are our concerns. We do not want to contribute to, you know, the death of our relatives in Alberta.
So the tar sands would probably be 30% bigger if the Northern Gateway Pipeline goes through, but they'll still have the other pipeline to Oklahoma then.
Yeah, so that's the big push for the Gateway Pipeline project, is to increase production at the tar sands by 30%. So with that increase, you know, there's going to be the need for more heavy-duty equipment, and we're seeing lots of the heavy haul issues here down in the U.S.
What's the status of the legal ways of blocking this pipeline in Canada? Is there a possibility there that it could be blocked through legal action?
Through legal action, I know many of our communities in the Carrier-Sault County Tribal Council are considering legal action, looking at the Canadian Environmental Assessment process. They don't have any mandate to consider Indigenous rights and title issues. Sorry. So, yeah, that's one of the big concerns.
I can always edit.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, legal action. But other ways that we are looking at is trying to push the federal government for a legislated ban on tanker traffic on the coast, because there's already a moratorium, but they're trying to, with this project, open up and, you know, do away with the moratorium.
Okay. Do you think civil disobedience might be in the cards if legal or political action fails?
Well, we are considering different forms of non-violent direct action. Our people are very against violence. So trying to find creative ways to show our resistance to such projects, because what we're seeing in, especially in British Columbia, where the pipeline's going to cross over 52 different First Nations traditional territories, many of us have never ceded, surrendered our territories by ways of treaty or any other means. So we are still the very sovereign owners or caretakers of the territories. So finding those ways and bringing our people back to the land and again trying to find creative ways to resist this project.
And finally, what do you expect to get out of the Tar Sands Resistance Summit that you're attending right now?
Well, one of the big issues is trying to raise more awareness on the Northern Gateway Pipeline project as well, because of the risk that it poses to increase production at Tar Sands by 30% and to make the other connections with other groups in the U.S. who are opposing, you know, the Keystone XL pipeline and the heavy haul traffic, and there's even word about the Utah tar sands being developed. So trying to make these connections and find a consistent message that we can all, you know, act together as one, because the tar sands is really the big issue.
That was Jasmine Thomas of CICUS, British Columbia, who is organizing against the Northern Enbridge Pipeline Project. Interviewed November 21st at the Tar Sands Resistance Summit in Potomac, Montana. This is Leslie Rist of Lenoir, Idaho. Rist, who is an economics professor at Lewis Clark State College, lives along U.S. Highway 12, which is the route ExxonMobil plans to use to transport giant megaloads weighing up to 295 tons apiece to the Alberta tar sands. If approved, the loads will take up both lanes of the winding, narrow highway through the mountains that parallels the Clearwater and Lockshaw Rivers, which are located in a federally designated wild and scenic river corridor.
So it's Leslie Rist, and do you want to be identified as working with a particular group or anything like that?
Well, working with Friends of the Clearwater and Fighting Goliath.
Okay. Now, you were talking a little bit earlier about the axle weight issue, and actually we have Governor Otter saying that the pressure on the individual tire pressure from these loads won't be anything more than a pickup truck. And then ExxonMobil says, well, it wouldn't be any more than a regular semi, if because the tire pressure will be distributed along the road because of all the axles. But there's other concepts at play here.
Well, you know, it's not logical to me is that if you have a fully loaded log truck, for example, you're dealing with approximately 80,000 pounds of weight. We know, clearly documented through engineering studies, that the wear and tear on our highway systems from 80,000 pound trucks is primarily responsible for breakdown. It's not passenger vehicles. So now let's zoom up to the megaloads, which weigh approximately 640,000 pounds. How does this even make sense? That while this weight might be distributed across the axles, it is still 640,000 pounds. So I think the logical conclusion is if 80,000 pound trucks contributed significantly to the wear and tear of our highways, what will 640,000 pound trucks do?
And so the taxpayers of Idaho are going to be stuck with the bill, is the way you're looking at it?
Absolutely. And, you know, we're not getting really hardcore numbers and data from our elected officials, nor are we getting this from IDT, of what the potential cost is going to be passed down to the Idaho taxpayers to their highways.
And that's because they haven't done that study, or they aren't releasing information?
Well, I think that this is a common pattern that we've witnessed in the behavior, particularly of oil companies, is that they downstream the cost of their profits to the taxpayers of cities, states, or national governments. And that's basically to say that when they're using our highways and causing damage to our highways, which they expect us as a taxpayer to pay, we pay the cost while the oil companies get to take the profit margin of not paying the cost. And I don't think that that's fair to the citizens of Idaho.
Okay. You were talking a little bit earlier about long-term collusion between the oil companies and Idaho's elected representatives. Tell me a little bit more of what you found out about that.
Well, what concerns me is when you look at the facts of how of the issues that opponents of the megaloads are unveiling, and this is documented by paper, by contract, by meetings. We now understand that this has been in the work and planning for 3 years between the oil companies negotiating with various parties and representatives in the state of Idaho, from the governor's office to IDT to the Forest Division. So this has been in planning for a long time. 2 years ago, there was a multi-million dollar road retrofit east of Kamiai, Idaho, up over the mountains.
On US 12?
Correct, on US 12. And so the claim is this was going to be work that was going to be done anyway. Well, I challenge that, because if it was just resurfacing the road, that would have been a singular issue. But what we see is a retrofitting of mega turnouts along a wild and scenic river that cannot be simply road maintenance. That was conditioning the road to facilitate the transport of these vehicles. Contracts now between the state of Idaho, IDT, show that this has not been a short-term, voila, we're just going to decide to use Highway 12 for our transport. The citizens of the state had been excluded and deliberately kept out of this process up until March, when IDT held three hearings, okay, with misinformation delivered to the public. They have not even followed their own rules, policies, procedures, and standards in moving the megaloads through the state of Idaho. They have given preferential treatment and standard to the oil companies. And as a citizen of the state, I object to that.
I did hear something yesterday that the new turnouts may already violate federal wild and scenic river designations.
That is correct. And, you know, one of the things that I speculate about collusionary behavior between elected government officials, IDT, and the oil companies is why did the state of Idaho, for example, refuse federal funding to retrofit these roads? I speculate that it was to avoid having to fulfill the federal mandate for an environmental impact study on the Lauksaw River.
Tell me just a little bit more about Idaho refusing federal funding. This is a common type of funding that comes down from the federal government for road improvements that states normally take.
Correct, matching funds. And Idaho is in such serious budgetary dilemmas right now. I mean, we're seeing cuts across the board in important issues like education, for example. Our roads are in terrible shape throughout the state. What logical reason would the state have to refuse federal matching funds? It doesn't make sense to me.
Did they refuse federal matching funds statewide, or is this just for this particular section of road?
I'm not sure about statewide, but I know that there wasn't federal funding involved in the Lauksaw retrofit.
Okay, which is rare.
It's rare, of course. Wouldn't you want some federal money if you were a governor and under budget constraints? And wouldn't you want to see a little bit of revenue come your way? Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's all the questions I have written down right now. Do you have any, comments maybe on the larger issues of the tar sands and what you've gotten out of the tar sands resistance summit?
Well, I'd like to comment on two things. Why is it that companies like ConocoPhillips and ExxonMobil would invest over $9 million at the Port of Lewiston point of transport prior to permits being issued unless they were sure they could make a return on their investment, number one. Number two, transportation through our state would be a moot issue if we were practicing sustainable business practices, and that's bring the work home, let Idaho laborers do the work of constructing, or Canadian workers or Montana workers of constructing rather than outsourcing American jobs to increase your profits, which is what the oil companies are doing. Why would you continue to bring modules into the Port of Lewiston and pay storage fees unless you were quite certain that you could bully and strong-arm your way through this state? That is a tactic long been used by the oil companies to force local communities into supporting their initiatives. So how does this all draw into the tar sands? I'm concerned not just for my backyard. I'm concerned for the people of Canada, the people of the world, that will pay the costs socially, economically, and environmentally of something as disastrous as we already know exists in the tar sands. These modules will help grow the tar sand damage to the economy, to the indigenous people, to society at large, and most certainly environment. So that's how this all ties together.
Okay. Well, I appreciate it. Just as a quick background question, you live in Lenoir. How far away do you live from US 12? I know it's not about your backyard.
And, you know, I'm not ashamed to say it's about my backyard. I think most citizens, if we're really honest, if somebody wanted to come build us, you know, a sewage treatment plant right next to our property, we might have a little bit of a problem with that. And how that affects me as an individual is that it affects my capital wealth, my investment in my property when a corporation comes in and does this. It devalues my life. My property borders Highway 12.
That was Leslie Rist of Lenoir, Idaho. Rist, who is an economics professor at Lewis Clark State College, lives along U.S. Highway 12, which is the route ExxonMobil plans to use to transport giant megaloads weighing up to 295 tons apiece to the Alberta tar sands. If approved, the loads will take up both lanes of the winding, narrow highway through the mountains that parallels the Clearwater and Lhoxaw Rivers, which are located in a federally designated wild and scenic river corridor. This is Missoula, Montana attorney Summer Nelson, interviewed November 21st at the Tar Sands Resistance Summit in Potomac, Montana.
Summer Nelson.
Okay, and you're an attorney in Missoula. So what can you say about the current status of the legal effort to stop the megaloads coming through Montana?
Well, there's been no litigation so far in Montana, and that's mostly because there's no final decision yet from the Montana Department of Transportation. So there are a number of organizations and individuals who are concerned about the potential decision, and if it looks similar to the original environmental assessment, there seem to be some deficiencies in the analysis, and the likely people would step up to challenge that.
Okay, and is MTD saying that it will issue the permits? Or are they implying that? I believe I read something that the head of the Montana Department of Transportation said they would.
They haven't said that explicitly. I think they're being careful not to, because really they can't issue the permits until they've done their environmental analysis and issued a final decision. But there are a lot of indicators that seem to suggest it's moving in that direction.
They're still waiting for Idaho, too.
They are. Idaho was saying they're making their permits contingent on Montana, and Montana has stated that they want to know that the rigs are going to get through Idaho before they issue their permits.
Okay. Do you think
that stopping the ConocoPhillips loads and the ExxonMobil loads are different cases legally? Are there differences legally in this?
I don't know if I'm prepared to comment, you know, legally, but as far as are they connected, I would say there's certainly evidence that the companies have been in contact, that both the Idaho and Montana Departments of Transportation have asked ConocoPhillips and Imperial Oil to communicate and coordinate about any changes that need to be made along the highways. So they're certainly, you know, needing to work together to make the highways passable for both of their rigs.
Is it possible that the loads might slip through legal cracks? For example, an ITD or an MTD permit gets approved before legal papers for a temporary injunction could be filed? Could that happen?
Well, at least in Montana, they have to have a final decision before there would be jurisdiction for a court to review the decision. So I think just the process itself would involve the permits being issued first, and then if anybody were going to challenge it in court, that they would have to act quickly, because presumably the companies would try to move as soon as they had the permits in hand.
Could the permit be issued like at 4:55 on a Friday night and then have no chance to stop things in court?
I suppose they could issue them at that time. I don't know if the companies would be prepared to move immediately. I also know for Imperial Oil, they still need to do construction in Montana before they can even move their equipment. They need to expand a number of turnouts, construct a number of new turnouts, and reinforce other turnouts before they can move through. So they won't be able to act on those permits immediately.
So if there is a filing for a temporary injunction, would there be a plaintiff, or would it be for the people of Montana, or would there be somebody with intervener status who lives along the road? How would that work?
Well, anybody who could show that they have standing, meaning that they'll be impacted in some personal way by the decision, could theoretically bring a lawsuit. That could be individuals along the route. It could be organizations that have members with interests along the route, say they use it recreationally or for business or for any other reason, you know, that they will be impacted by the changes to the infrastructure and the exclusive use of, you know, at the time of these rigs being transported.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to add? Maybe, what you're planning to get out of this tar sands resistance summit?
Well, the summit has been a really great opportunity just to bring a lot of people together who are being impacted in a number of ways, and to be able to see just the breadth of the impacts of tar sands and all the different pieces, such as the hauling and the pipelines, will have on various communities and how interconnected everyone is.
Okay. Any other legal issues that you might want to bring up right now in an interview?
I think, you know, the biggest concerns that people have recognized so far is just the lack of disclosure of the true impacts and possibilities of this project. In the environmental assessment, the draft environmental assessment from Montana Department of Transportation, they completely left out, you know, certain impacts that will be related to the project, restricted its scope just to Montana borders, even though, you know, people in Montana and Idaho use both, you know, roads. They cross the border for recreation, for business. They're part of the same interconnected communities, and just a lot of the impacts have not been truly analyzed and disclosed.
For example?
Well, some of the emergency response concerns, when these rigs are traveling on especially Highway 12 and parts of Highway 200, once you get into Montana, they're only two lanes wide, and the equipment is going to occupy the entire two-lane highway. So there are a number of concerns, including that the county of Missoula has expressed, you know, how is emergency response going to function when they cannot get around one of these transports for 10 minutes or possibly more if things aren't going smoothly, and especially with private vehicles, when people are transporting loved ones in emergency situations to an emergency room, and how will they be able to negotiate the loads that are occupying the entire highway? So that's one of the serious concerns that people have identified, and that was not addressed in the initial environmental assessment.
So there could be an appeal of the environmental assessment that it was done wrong.
Well, we're waiting for the Department of Transportation to finalize that environmental assessment.
Somebody's asked for a full EIS too, right?
Yeah, a number of people have asked for an environmental impact statement because this project really lends itself more to an environmental impact statement because of all the interconnected and cumulative impacts that could occur along the entire route and at the end of the route, you know, where the equipment will be used for further tar sands development. You know, really just the scope of the impacts is so immense that an environmental impact statement would be more appropriate.
Okay, I think that's all. So they're going to be up on 200 right out here, huh?
Yep, they'll be coming right by our summit location.
That was Missoula, Montana attorney Summer Nelson, interviewed November 21st at the Tar Sands Resistance Summit in Potomac, Montana. This is Nick Stocks of the Missoula-based Northern Rockies Rising Tide, interviewed November 21st at the Tar Sands Resistance Summit in Potomac, Montana.
This Resistance Summit is about three quarters over now. I guess there's another day. Tell me what people have accomplished so far, first of all.
I think the biggest thing that we've accomplished so far is bringing folks who haven't had the ability or the chance to come together to strategize and to trade sort of stories. We've brought them together to be able to do that. And I think one of the goals that we had in the summit was to bring those people together so we could all collectively strategize and we could all collectively move forward in opposition to the tar sands while still focusing on our individual campaigns or the individual things that all of the different impacted communities are working on. And I think so far we've fairly successfully done that. Yeah.
Well, what should people out there know about the strategy as it's developed so far from the summit?
I think coming into the summit, we had a particular goal to meet, and our goal was to realize that all of the impacts that tar sands and the tar sands infrastructure projects pose are felt really locally. And so local struggles are the kind of heart and soul of sort of advocacy against the tar sands. And I think that the summit sort of surrounding that goal, I think we've been really successful in meeting that goal here in terms of allowing space for everybody to sort of talk and communicate about their own personal struggles and then allowing space for people to strategize how to work on all those things together.
Okay. Now, I interviewed an attorney here, and you know, she was saying that you know, legal actions will be taken in Montana if the megaloads come through, and there's, you know, talk about resistance to pipelines because that would allow the Alberta tar sands to develop even further. And I'm sort of wondering what people should know about if the legal system breaks down or hiccups and misinterprets a law and you know, direct action is needed. You guys have been planning for that possibility too?
I think different kinds of community groups are planning for different kinds of action. And so I think that participatory public action has been sort of a longstanding history in terms of fights like these. And I think that people are sort of moving in those directions as these things take form. We're sort of like keeping all options on the table, as it were. So,
right. And you know, the reason for this being more than, you know, maybe just a lawsuit situation is because of the great economic and social impacts of the tar sands. Is that essentially why you were involved in the issue?
We became involved in the issue because we knew about the tar sands, but also through the through this process. But and then we learned about the heavy haul. We knew about the tar sands first, then we learned about the heavy haul. But through this process, we've sort of like gained this increased knowledge of the complexity of what the tar sands are and the impacts different communities, the impacts upon different communities that the tar sands sort of like produce. And I think that for us, the real fight was around, again, like the local impact and the local struggle. And then we saw ourselves as a way of, we saw one of the goals of Northern Rockies Rising Tide was to kind of bridge between, to act as a bridge between the heavy haul and the shipments and a lot of the local struggles to the kind of international, national, international context that those struggles are in.
So a lot of the local struggles will be more connected and doing things in concert now?
I don't know if they'll be doing things exactly in concert, but I think there's, we opened up the space for people to communicate about doing things like that. And so I think that the context people have made here and the context that we've sort of set the summit in the heavy haul campaign in will be, part of the focus will be a little bit more national and international. And so in the same breath as saying we oppose the heavy haul because of the Locksaw River, we can say that we, in solidarity, oppose the heavy haul because of the tar sands.
Do you think people who are listening that might be wanting to get involved in these issues should, you know, use their local organizations, or if maybe they're not along one of the heavy haul or pipeline routes, is there a national way to connect in?
I think that if folks on a local level are interested in getting involved, especially if they live in Idaho, Montana, there's a number of organizations that work on these things that people can plug into. If they live along the Columbia River, there's folks in Portland and Eugene and Seattle and all throughout Oregon, Washington, who are also working on this issue with us. And beyond that, there's a lot of ways to oppose the tar sands, no matter what community you're a part of. Sometimes in solidarity, and sometimes because a pipeline runs through your community, or Exxon or ConocoPhillips may have headquarters in your community. So I think there's a lot of ways for community organizations to pose solidarity actions with people who are opposing the tar sands.
Is there a spearhead organization nationally or internationally?
I think one of the most amazing things about doing tar sands, like anti-tar sands organizing work, is that really the folks that have been at the forefront of this fight have almost consistently been local community members, and so the issues surrounding the tar sands and impacted communities have been brought forth and like brought onto the international stage by local community members. And I think that's really sort of amazing thing that defines this struggle. So this isn't stuff that's coming from the outside. This is stuff that really uniquely is coming up from the inside and is then being supported by some of the organizations on the outside.
Okay. I guess that's all the questions. This is probably your big chance to do an organizing summit of this type. At least with the imminence of the big hauls, as we're calling them, the megaloads. Do you think there'll be other summits like this in the future over the tar sands issue?
Oh, absolutely. I think that there's already been a lot of summits, especially in Canada. There have been a lot of camps like this one. This is one of the ones I think that's fairly unique in the United States portion of this, but I think that people are planning for others already. I think there's going to be one probably in the spring, actually. So
that was Nick Stocks of the Missoula-based Northern Rockies Rising Tide, interviewed November 21st at the Tar Sands Resistance Summit in Potomac, Montana.